Hi, this is James Marker, and you can call me Jim once again, and welcome to the second episode of An Angry Boomer's Take. So many things have happened within this past week. It's like future shock. It's happening so fast, it's hard to even keep up with everything that's happening, especially with the tariffs in the economy, with the DEI developments, just so many things going on that I would really like to get into. But first, I'd like to discuss what it was like as a boomer. When I got my first bank account in the early 70s, my savings account paid an interest rate. I got paid 4.25% on a savings account. I opened up a checking account by the time I was 16 years old, and I was getting 3% interest with my checking account. Can you imagine that? I was getting interest out of a checking account. I actually saved for anything that I wanted to buy. I didn't have a credit card. I didn't have credit. I saved my money, and when I had enough money to make that purchase, that's what I did. That's how it was for all of us until the 80s rolled around. Along came Ronald Reagan in 1980, and everything changed. He promoted consumerism. With that, my savings account, interest rates just went right out the door. We didn't get paid interest on that. In fact, now the banks are even charging us to have our money in the bank. Another thing that really changed, at that time, many jobs paid pensions when you retired. And Reagan changed that into a 401k system, which initially was meant to enhance pensions. But as the years went on throughout the Reagan era and after, many pensions were eliminated and 401k became your method of saving. And that's what I'm getting to right now, our 401ks. It seems that Donald Trump is tanking the stock market. If you're an investor, you can pull your money out and reinvest it. You can sell high and buy low. But with your 401k, you're basically screwed. While the rich are taking their money out at its peak, your money's just dropping lower and lower and lower. Your retirement savings, they're going down the drain. And then the rich will turn around and buy low, and you're the overall loser in this game. Ron Johnson was talking about Trump's tariffs, and I quote him. He said, "This is something President Trump has believed in for decades. He is absolutely dedicated to it. I think it's a reasonably high risk. It's a very bold move. He will either reap the rewards or suffer the consequences." Well, the problem I have with Ron Johnson's statement is, will Trump suffer the consequences, or will over 300 million Americans' retirement savings suffer the consequences? That's the problem. He's dealing with house money. He's at the table making big gambles, throwing all his chips in, but it's our money he's playing with. Trump may reap the rewards, take the credit for it as the rich get richer, but in the end, all of us in the middle and lower classes, we're only going to get poorer. It's a game where the rich will always get richer. With all of the events that have happened within the past few days and week, including the tariffs, the market tanking, tariffs on penguins, it shows you really how well thought out their plan was, putting tariffs on penguins, which is just so crazy. So I thought I would have another episode where I'm going to talk to the OpenAI voice, Noah, once again, because I have a lot of pertinent questions to ask Noah about the recent events that have happened within the past week. Noah, how are you doing this week?
I am doing fine. Thank you, Jim.
I'm going to start off with a question about the tariffs. Do American economists support tariffs?
Most American economists generally oppose tariffs, as they tend to see them as distortions to free trade that reduce overall economic efficiency. The mainstream economic view, based on principles of comparative advantage, suggests that free trade leads to greater economic growth and lower consumer prices. Tariffs, on the other hand, can lead to higher prices, retaliatory measures from trading partners, and inefficiencies in resource allocation. That said, some economists support tariffs in specific cases, such as when it comes to protecting infant industries. Some argue that temporary tariffs can help emerging industries develop until they become competitive globally. There are some national security concerns to consider. Tariffs on critical industries, like semiconductors or steel, may be justified to reduce dependence on foreign suppliers. Then there are unfair trade practices. Some economists support tariffs as a response to dumping, subsidies, or intellectual property theft. Lastly, strategic trade policy can come into play. In certain cases, tariffs can be used to gain leverage in trade negotiations. While politicians and policymakers may advocate for tariffs based on political or strategic reasons, the consensus among economists remains that free trade, rather than protectionism, leads to long-term economic growth.
There have been questions about the formula that the Trump administration used for their tariffs. What formula did the Trump administration use to enact their worldwide tariffs? Is there any precedent for this formula? And is it backed by thorough and exact research findings?
The Trump administration implemented a reciprocal tariff policy aimed at reducing the United States' trade deficits with various countries. The formula used calculated the tariff rate necessary to balance the bilateral trade deficit with each trading partner. Specifically, the administration determined the value of a country's trade barriers by dividing the U.S. trade deficit with that country by the value of that country's exports to the United States, then having the result to set the tariff rate. For example, with a 2024 U.S. goods trade deficit of $295 billion with China and $439 billion in imports from China, the calculation was $295 billion divided by $439 billion divided by 2 would equal 33.6%, leading to a proposed tariff rate of approximately 33.6% on Chinese imports. This approach does not have a clear precedent in U.S. trade policy. Historically, tariff implementations have been based on detailed analyses of specific industries, national security considerations, or negotiated trade agreements rather than a formula directly linking tariffs to bilateral trade deficits. The formula's validity and effectiveness have been questioned by economists and trade experts. Anson Soderberry, an economics professor at Purdue University, stated that attributing trade imbalances solely to trade barriers lacks foundation in economic theory, and that using such a reductionist formula is misguided. Additionally, the U.S. Trade Representative's fact sheet on the tariff calculations cited academic studies, but authors of these studies expressed concerns about the administration's conclusions, indicating that the formula oversimplifies complex trade dynamics and does not account for factors like changes in exports due to domestic price increases or retaliatory measures by trading partners. In summary, the Trump administration's tariff formula was a novel approach without direct precedent and was not supported by thorough and exact research findings, according to several economists and trade experts.
There seems to be an immediate negative stock market reaction to Donald Trump's tariffs. Goldman Sachs has now raised their probability of a recession occurring because of the tariffs. Will these tariffs create a recession? And if so, what would a recession look like for the average American?
Yes, Jim. Recent reports indicate that Goldman Sachs has raised the probability of a U.S. recession to 35% in the next 12 months, up from a previous estimate of 20%. This adjustment is largely attributed to the recent implementation of extensive tariffs by President Donald Trump, which are expected to increase inflation and slow economic growth. While it's not certain that the tariffs will lead to a recession, many economists express concern that they could act as a significant drag on the economy. The tariffs are likely to increase the cost of imported goods, leading to higher prices for consumers and businesses. This inflationary pressure can reduce consumer spending and business investment, potentially slowing economic growth. Additionally, affected countries may retaliate with their own tariffs, further impacting U.S. exports and potentially leading to job losses in export-dependent industries. For example, Moody's Analytics has increased its recession probability estimate to 40%, citing potential for a recession by design due to these trade policies. What would a recession look like for the average American? Well, if a recession were to occur, the average American could experience several adverse effects, such as job losses and unemployment. Companies may reduce their workforce to cut costs, leading to higher unemployment rates. This can make finding new employment more challenging. There would most likely be reduced income and benefits. Even for those who retain their jobs, there might be wage freezes, reduced hours, or cuts to benefits such as bonuses and employer-sponsored health insurance. Another thing to consider is increased cost of living. Tariffs can lead to higher prices on imported goods, effectively increasing the cost of everyday items and reducing disposable income. Estimates suggest that the average household could pay approximately $3,800 more annually due to these increased costs. Then there are housing market impacts. Economic downturns can lead to declining home values and increased foreclosure rates, affecting homeowners' equity and financial stability. Finally, there could very well be investment and retirement savings declines. Stock market volatility during recessions can diminish the value of investment portfolios and retirement accounts, impacting long-term financial plans. In summary, while it's not guaranteed that the recent tariffs will cause recession, they have increased the risk. A recession could lead to job losses, reduced incomes, higher living costs, and declines in investments, all of which would negatively impact the average American's financial well-being.
I'm going to go on to another subject about DEI. Trump announced he's going after ABC to remove their broadcast license over their DEI policies. Is this a direct violation of ABC's First Amendment rights? Is this something Goebbels would have done in modern-day America?
President Trump's announcement of intentions to revoke ABC's broadcast license over its diversity, equity, and inclusion policies raises significant First Amendment concerns. The First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution prohibits government actions that abridge the freedom of speech or press. Targeting a media organization for its editorial decisions or internal policies, such as DEI initiatives, could be interpreted as governmental overreach into protected free speech and press freedoms. Historically, the Federal Communications Commission has maintained a degree of independence from political influence, ensuring that broadcast licensing decisions are made based on objective criteria rather than political considerations. However, recent developments indicate a shift. FCC Chairman Brendan Carr, appointed by President Trump, has initiated investigations into media companies like Disney, ABC's parent company, concerning their DEI practices. Carr asserts that these investigations aim to ensure compliance with equal employment opportunity regulations and to prevent discriminatory practices. Critics argue that such actions represent an attempt to intimidate media organizations and can infringe upon First Amendment rights. Drawing a parallel to historical instances, Joseph Goebbels, as the Nazi minister of propaganda, exercised extensive control over German media to suppress dissent and promote state ideology. Goebbels' ministry implemented strict censorship, controlled news content, and dictated cultural expression to align with Nazi objectives. Such centralized control over the media was instrumental in manipulating public opinion and stifling opposition. While the context differs significantly, governmental actions that seek to influence or control media content based on ideological positions bear resemblance to tactics employed by authoritarian regimes. In democratic societies, the independence of the press serves as a fundamental check on governmental power. Efforts to revoke broadcast licenses or otherwise penalize media organizations for their internal policies or editorial decisions can undermine this independence and may constitute a violation of constitutional protections. In summary, President Trump's move to challenge ABC's broadcast license over DEI policies raises critical questions about the balance between government authority and First Amendment rights. Such actions, reminiscent of historical instances of media suppression, underscore the importance of safeguarding press freedom to maintain a healthy and functioning democracy.
Then, with Trump's anti-DEI stance being forced on private industry, and Trump is trying to enact voting laws that disproportionately negatively affect lower-income minority voters' ability to vote and to register to vote, is America on its way to becoming a Jim Crow state?
The Trump administration has implemented policies affecting both diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in private industry and voting regulations, prompting discussions about their potential impact on minority communities. It affects DEI policies in private industry. In January 2025, President Trump issued an executive order directing federal agencies to eliminate DEI programs within the government and encouraging the private sector to follow suit. The order tasked the Attorney General with recommending enforcement measures to ensure private companies discontinue DEI practices deemed discriminatory. Legal experts suggest that while the administration may lack direct authority to mandate changes in private sector DEI policies, the executive order's language implies potential legal actions against companies maintaining such initiatives. Then with voting regulations, the administration has advocated for stricter voting laws, including enhanced voter identification requirements and measures that may complicate voter registration processes. Critics argue that these changes could disproportionately affect lower-income and minority voters by imposing barriers that hinder their participation in elections. For instance, in North Carolina, efforts to implement restrictive voter ID laws and complicate mail-in ballot procedures have been shown to impact Black voters more significantly. With a comparison to Jim Crow, the Jim Crow era, spanning from the late 19th century to the mid-20th century, was characterized by laws enforcing racial segregation and disenfranchising Black Americans through literacy tests, poll taxes, and other discriminatory practices. While current policies differ in form and context, concerns have been raised that certain measures may lead to outcomes reminiscent of voter suppression tactics from that period. Organizations like the American Civil Liberties Union have expressed apprehension that recent voting regulations could make it more challenging for marginalized groups to vote, echoing historical patterns of disenfranchisement. In conclusion, while the administration's actions regarding DEI policies and voting regulations have sparked debate about their implications for minority communities, equating these developments directly to the establishment of a Jim Crow state involves complex considerations. It is essential to analyze these policies critically, monitor their impacts on affected populations, and engage in informed discourse to ensure that principles of equity and democratic participation are upheld.
So you are basically saying it's a wait-and-see type of situation when it comes to Trump's policies and the possible outcome of becoming a Jim Crow state.
The Trump administration's recent policies, including the rollback of diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives and the implementation of stricter voting regulations, have raised concerns about their potential impact on minority communities. These actions have already led to significant consequences, such as federal employee layoffs that disproportionately affect Black workers and legal challenges from those dismissed due to DEI-related activities. While these developments are concerning, equating them directly to the establishment of a Jim Crow state involves complex considerations. The Jim Crow era was characterized by explicit laws enforcing racial segregation and disenfranchisement. Currently, the situation involves policy shifts that may disproportionately affect minority communities, but they do not constitute legally mandated segregation. It is crucial to remain vigilant and critically assess the implementation and impact of these policies. Ongoing monitoring and legal challenges are essential to ensure that the rights of all citizens are upheld and that the nation does not regress towards systemic discrimination.
Are Trump's DEI initiatives a subtle form of employment segregation?
The Trump administration has implemented policies aimed at dismantling diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives within both the public and private sectors. A notable action is Executive Order 14173, titled Ending Illegal Discrimination and Restoring Merit-Based Opportunity, signed on January 21, 2025. This order rescinded previous mandates that promoted affirmative action and non-discrimination requirements for federal contractors, arguing that such DEI programs foster intergroup hostility and authoritarianism and deviate from merit-based principles. The administration contends that DEI initiatives may lead to biased and unlawful employment practices, asserting that preferences based on race, gender, or other protected characteristics are discriminatory. The U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has signaled a shift in enforcement priorities, warning employers that certain DEI policies might be illegal if they involve employment actions influenced by an individual's protected characteristics. Critics argue that these measures could undermine efforts to promote workplace diversity and inclusion, potentially leading to environments where systemic biases persist unchallenged. By discouraging DEI programs, there is concern that workplaces may become less accommodating to historically marginalized groups, which could inadvertently reinforce patterns of employment segregation. The rescission of Executive Order 11246, which had mandated affirmative action programs to promote equal employment opportunities since 1965, further amplifies these concerns. While the administration emphasizes a return to merit-based hiring, the elimination of DEI initiatives raises questions about how merit is defined and whether systemic barriers that affect equal opportunity are being adequately addressed. The absence of proactive diversity measures may not constitute over-employment segregation, but could lead to workplaces that lack representation and inclusivity, thereby perpetuating disparities. In summary, the Trump administration's actions against DEI initiatives have sparked a complex debate. While not amounting to explicit employment segregation, these policies may hinder progress toward more inclusive and diverse workplaces, potentially allowing existing inequalities to persist.
Could the end result of Trump's DEI initiatives result in a more white male-dominated white-collar job workforce?
The Trump administration's recent actions against diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives have led to significant changes in both public and private sectors. These policies have prompted companies to reevaluate and, in some cases, scale back their diversity programs. For instance, Google has discontinued certain diversity hiring goals to comply with new government contractor rules, and other organizations have followed suit. The elimination of DEI programs may lead to a reduction in proactive efforts to recruit and support underrepresented groups in the workforce. Without these initiatives, there's a concern that hiring and promotion practices could revert to favoring the majority demographic, potentially resulting in a more homogeneous, white male-dominated white-collar workforce. This shift could undermine decades of progress toward creating inclusive and diverse professional environments. While the administration emphasizes a return to merit-based systems, critics argue that such an approach may overlook systemic barriers that DEI programs aim to address. The long-term impact of these policy changes remains to be seen, but the current trajectory suggests a potential decrease in workplace diversity and inclusivity.
When Donald Trump speaks of merit-based hiring practices, the definition of merit is somewhat arbitrary. Is it possible or likely that being a white male could be one of the merit metrics utilized in hiring practices?
Yes. The definition of merit in hiring can be subjective and influenced by implicit biases, industry norms, and historical power structures. While merit-based hiring is generally framed as selecting the most qualified candidate based on skills, experience, and performance, the criteria used to define merit are not always neutral. Historically, workplaces have often favored characteristics associated with dominant groups in the U.S. that has frequently meant white males in white-collar industries. If Trump's rollback of DEI policies leads to hiring practices that ignore systemic barriers and existing biases, it is possible that being a white male could be informally or even structurally advantaged in hiring decisions. For example, cultural fit and network effects. If hiring managers unconsciously associate merit with traits they are most familiar with, they may favor candidates from similar backgrounds, often white men in leadership roles. Then there are legacy advantages. Without DEI initiatives, hiring practices could favor individuals from prestigious universities or specific industries that have historically been dominated by white men. Also, there are subjective hiring metrics. If companies do not use structured, unbiased hiring processes, subjective factors such as leadership presence or communication style could disadvantage underrepresented groups. While explicit racial or gender preferences in hiring would violate anti-discrimination laws, the elimination of DEI programs could result in hiring practices that inadvertently reinforce existing demographic patterns. In that sense, merit-based hiring could function as a veneer for maintaining a workforce that skews white and male.
Trump seems to be using DEI to scrub historical government and military achievements made by minorities, gays, and women from publicly accessible data. Is this a form of revisionist history? Once again, this tactic seems similar to the tactics Goebbels used in the mid-1930s Nazi Germany.
The Trump administration's recent actions to remove references to the achievements of minorities, women, and LGBTQ+ individuals from government and military records have raised significant concerns about historical revisionism. For instance, the Pentagon has deleted online content honoring Black Medal of Honor recipient Army Major General Charles Calvin Rogers and the World War II Japanese American 442nd Regimental Combat Team. Although some of these pages have been restored following public outcry, the initiative to purge DEI content persists. Similarly, Nassau has been reported to remove mentions of women and minorities from its websites, prompting criticism and concerns about the erasure of significant contributions made by these groups. These actions can be viewed as a form of revisionist history, which involves altering the historical record to serve particular ideological goals. By eliminating acknowledgments of the contributions made by marginalized groups, such measures risk distorting the comprehensive narrative of the nation's history. Drawing parallels to historical instances, Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi minister of propaganda, employed extensive control over media and information to manipulate public perception and suppress dissenting viewpoints. Goebbels' propaganda machine was instrumental in promoting the Nazi ideology by controlling all forms of communication, including the press, radio, and arts, thereby reshaping historical narratives to align with their objectives. While the context differs significantly, the current efforts to remove DEI content from public records echo tactics used by authoritarian regimes to control historical narratives and marginalize certain groups. Such actions not only undermine the recognition of diverse contributions to society, but also risk repeating patterns of exclusion and discrimination observed in history. In summary, the removal of content celebrating the achievements of minorities, women, and LGBTQ+ individuals from government and military records represents a concerning move toward historical revisionism. This approach bears resemblance to past propaganda strategies aimed at controlling public perception and suppressing the acknowledgement of diverse contributions to national history.
Now, getting on to another topic, Trump is in the process of eliminating the Department of Education. Would the elimination of the Department of Education disproportionately affect marginalized students and education efforts in small rural communities?
President Donald Trump's executive order to dismantle the U.S. Department of Education has sparked significant debate regarding its potential impact on marginalized students and those in small rural communities. The Department of Education plays a crucial role in administering federal funding and enforcing educational policies designed to promote equity and support vulnerable populations. It will most likely have a drastic negative impact on marginalized students. The Department of Education oversees programs that provide essential support to marginalized groups, including students with disabilities, low-income families, and racial minorities. For instance, it administers Title I funding, which allocates financial assistance to schools with high percentages of children from low-income families to help ensure that all students meet challenging academic standards. Eliminating the department could jeopardize these funds, potentially widening educational disparities. Former Education Secretary Arne Duncan has expressed concern that such cuts pose a direct threat to vulnerable students, particularly those in Black and brown communities. It could very well have a severe impact on rural communities. Rural communities often rely heavily on federal funding to support their educational systems. The Department of Education provides resources for special education services, early intervention programs, and grants that are vital for schools in these areas. Without federal oversight and funding, rural schools may struggle to maintain these programs, leading to diminished educational opportunities for students. Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel highlighted that dismantling the department threatens vital federal education funding, which amounts to approximately $1.5 billion for Michigan alone, supporting services such as special education and early intervention. Then there are legal and political challenges. The executive order to eliminate the Department of Education is expected to face legal challenges and requires congressional approval. Civil rights groups, including the NAACP and the National Education Association, have filed lawsuits arguing that the move is unconstitutional and threatens to undo decades of progress toward educational equity. In conclusion, the proposed elimination of the Department of Education raises significant concerns about the potential adverse effects on marginalized students and those in rural communities. The loss of federal oversight and funding could exacerbate existing educational inequalities, making it imperative to carefully consider and address these potential consequences.
It almost seems as though the MAGA's attack on public education and reshaping public education by dictating curriculum based on political and religious ideology and banning books that provide alternate views to their own rigid ideology is an effort to dumb down future generations while making them more compliant to a strict far-right extremist ideology. How is this any different than Muslim fundamentalist-controlled governments?
The push by some MAGA-aligned politicians to reshape public education through banning books, restricting discussions on race and gender, and promoting a curriculum aligned with conservative political and religious ideology does raise concerns about intellectual freedom and critical thinking in schools. The imposition of rigid ideological narratives over objective education can be compared to tactics used by authoritarian regimes, including some Muslim fundamentalist-controlled governments, where education is strictly controlled to promote a singular worldview. Here are a few key similarities. First, there is a censorship of dissenting ideas. The MAGA movement is seeking to ban books and initiate restrictions on discussions related to race, gender, and historical injustices. An example is Florida removing DEI programs and limiting education on systemic racism. With fundamentalist governments, there is banning books and materials that contradict religious law or challenge the ruling ideology. Secondly, there is state-controlled curriculum. With the MAGA movement, there are laws restricting what teachers can discuss in classrooms, like Florida's restrictions on discussing LGBTQ+ topics in schools. With fundamental governments, there are strict religious education mandates, often eliminating secular subjects that encourage critical thinking or alternative perspectives. Thirdly, there is the undermining secular education. With the MAGA movement, there are increasing efforts to defund public schools, promote religious charter schools, and inject Christian nationalist perspectives into education. With fundamentalist governments, there is a replacing of secular education with religious schooling to ensure ideological conformity. Lastly, there is the creation of a compliant population. The MAGA movement is trying to limit exposure to diverse perspectives, which can result in future generations that are less equipped to question authority or critically analyze political rhetoric. With fundamentalist governments, they use indoctrination through education, is used to enforce obedience, and discourage questioning of religious and governmental authority. The key differences are, with legal and structural safeguards, the U.S. still has constitutional protections, independent courts, and activist resistance that can push back against ideological overreach in education. Then there is pluralistic society to consider. Unlike some fundamentalist states, the U.S. remains a diverse, multi-religious, and multi-ethnic democracy, which makes complete ideological control more difficult. In conclusion, while the MAGA approach to education does not yet reach the level of outright theocratic rule, the parallels with fundamentalist governments are concerning. Both involve the use of education as a tool for ideological control, censorship of dissenting viewpoints, and suppression of critical thinking to produce a more compliant population. If left unchecked, such policies could lead to a generation that is less capable of independent thought and more susceptible to authoritarian governance.
Social media platforms seem to be getting worse with allowing disinformation campaigns. Even though disinformation is technically freedom of speech, what recourse do we have in America to combat disinformation and foreign propaganda?
You're right, Jim. Disinformation campaigns, both domestic and foreign, have become a major issue, especially with the rise of social media. While freedom of speech protects a broad range of expression, including misleading or false information, there are still several legal, governmental, and societal tools available to combat disinformation and foreign propaganda in America. There are legal and governmental measures, such as counterintelligence and cybersecurity agencies. The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency and other intelligence agencies monitor and combat foreign disinformation campaigns, particularly those aimed at influencing elections. The Foreign Agents Registration Act, FARA, requires individuals and entities acting on behalf of foreign governments to disclose their activities. The Department of Justice prosecutes foreign influence operations when they violate U.S. laws. Then there's regulation and legislative actions. Bipartisan efforts like the proposed Honest Ads Act aim to increase transparency for political ads on social media. The Forum Align Influence Center within the Office of the Director of National Intelligence works to identify and counteract foreign propaganda. There are also platform accountability and content moderation to consider. While private companies have the right to set their own policies, there have been congressional hearings pressuring platforms like Facebook, X, and TikTok to crack down on misinformation. Social media companies can be held legally liable in some cases, such as when disinformation leads to direct harm, such as lawsuits against platforms for facilitating violence. Then there are societal and individual actions, such as media literacy and fact-checking. Organizations like Snopes, PolitiFact, and FactCheck that help debunk misinformation. There are also educational programs that promote media literacy, teaching people how to identify credible sources. Public pressure and consumer action are also in play, as users can report misleading content to platforms and advertisers can be pressured to withdraw funding from platforms that allow unchecked disinformation. There are also some state and local initiatives in place where some states have passed laws requiring digital literacy education in public schools, and some local governments are partnering with tech companies to provide real-time election disinformation alerts. There are many challenges, though. Striking the right balance between combating falsehoods and preserving free speech is difficult. As disinformation tactics evolve rapidly, it makes it really hard to regulate in real time, especially with foreign actors using encrypted messaging and decentralized platforms to spread propaganda. In conclusion, there is no single solution to disinformation, but a combination of government oversight, tech industry responsibility, and public education can help minimize its effects. Strengthening media literacy and holding social media companies accountable are two of the most effective ways to push back against disinformation while respecting freedom of speech.
Noah, what causes people to believe obvious lies and to reject the truth? Is this a form of mass psychosis combined with groupthink?
Yes, Jim. The tendency for people to believe obvious lies while rejecting the truth is often influenced by mass psychosis, groupthink, cognitive biases, and emotional manipulation. While it may not always meet the clinical definition of psychosis, a break from reality, it can function similarly on a societal scale. Here's how these psychological and social dynamics contribute. First, there is mass psychosis and collective delusion to consider. Mass psychosis occurs when a large segment of the population loses touch with reality due to widespread fear, propaganda, or ideological conditioning. Historical events like the Salem Witch Trials or Nazi Germany showcase how fear-driven narratives can lead to collective irrationality. Here are some modern parallels. Disinformation campaigns, such as QAnon, leverage fear, uncertainty, and scapegoating to create an alternate reality that adherents believe in fervently. Secondly, there is groupthink and social identity. With groupthink, people align with the beliefs of their in-group to maintain harmony and avoid social ostracization. Then there are echo chambers. Social media algorithms reinforce groupthink by exposing users primarily to content that aligns with their existing views. Also, there's a fear of isolation. Those who question dominant group narratives risk being labeled as traitors, which discourages independent thinking. Thirdly, there are cognitive biases that reinforce false beliefs. There is confirmation bias. People seek out information that aligns with their pre-existing beliefs and reject contradictory evidence. There is a Dunning-Kruger effect. Those with the least knowledge on a topic may overestimate their understanding, making them more susceptible to misinformation. There is also the backfire effect. When confronted with evidence that disproves their belief, some people actually become more committed to their false belief as a defense mechanism. Finally, the illusory truth effect. Repeated exposure to a lie makes it feel more true, even when it's debunked. Additionally, there is emotional manipulation and fear-based narratives. Like fear and anxiety, people are more likely to believe misinformation when they feel threatened. Statements such as, they are coming for your rights, your jobs, your children. Also, there's us versus them thinking. Propagandists create clear heroes and villains, making followers feel morally justified in rejecting facts. Authority worship is also a very huge factor with the MAGA movement. If a trusted leader promotes a falsehood, many followers will accept it uncritically rather than questioning someone they admire. Lastly, there are media influence and disinformation strategies, like propaganda and repetition. If a lie is repeated enough, especially by authoritative voices, it becomes embedded in the collective consciousness. Then there's weaponized skepticism. Misinformation campaigns often encourage people to do their own research, but direct them toward biased or fabricated sources. the promotion of the distrust of institutions is very prevalent. Decades of eroding trust in media, government, and science have made some people more willing to believe conspiratorial explanations over verified facts. How can we counteract this phenomenon? We can promote media literacy. Teach people to critically evaluate sources and distinguish between credible journalism and propaganda. We can encourage open dialogue. Rather than ridiculing false beliefs, engaging in respectful conversations can slowly help people reassess their views. We can strengthen emotional resilience. People who are less driven by fear are more likely to think critically and resist manipulative narratives. In conclusion, believing in obvious lies and rejecting the truth is not just ignorance. It is often psychological, social, and emotional conditioning. While it can resemble mass psychosis, it is largely a product of group dynamics, cognitive biases, and propaganda tactics that exploit human vulnerabilities. Understanding these mechanisms is key to pushing back against mass delusion and fostering critical thinking in society.
Getting on to Elon Musk. Has a non-governmental employee oligarch ever had as much influence on American governance as Elon Musk has right now?
Elon Musk's influence is arguably broader than any past non-governmental figure because he operates at the intersection of technology, defense, space, media, and energy. While figures like J.P. Morgan, Rockefeller, and Murdoch shape major aspects of governance, Musk's control over communication platforms, military technology, and economic infrastructure makes him a one-of-a-kind power broker in U.S. history.
Elon Musk seems to be voiding governmental contracts of his competitors and awarding them to his own companies, sometimes at a higher cost to the taxpayers. This seems to be a conflict of interest at the bare minimum, but it's really corruption being conducted right in front of our faces. Would you agree?
Yes, Jim. If Elon Musk is influencing government contract awards to favor his own companies while avoiding competitors' contracts, especially at higher cost to taxpayers, that would indeed represent a serious conflict of interest and could be considered corrupt behavior. This is why it would be corruption or a conflict of interest. There is monopolistic control over government contracts. SpaceX, Starlink, Tesla, and other Musk-owned entities receive billions in government funding through NASA, the Pentagon, and infrastructure initiatives. If Musk uses his influence to shut out competitors, this reduces fair competition, potentially leading to higher costs and worse outcomes for taxpayers. If government officials favor Musk's companies due to his political connections, social influence, or direct lobbying, it raises ethical and legal concerns. Any voiding of existing contracts without valid performance-related reasons suggests cronyism, where contracts are awarded based on influence rather than merit. There is a real lack of oversight and accountability. Unlike traditional government contractors like Boeing or Lockheed Martin, Musk has unprecedented direct influence over policymakers through social media and his status as a visionary. The U.S. government typically requires competitive bidding for contracts, but loopholes and political maneuvering may allow Musk to bypass these checks. You may ask, is this different from past corporate government corruption? Defense contractors like Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and Raytheon have long benefited from government favoritism. However, Musk's level of direct influence over multiple industries, space, defense, AI, communications, and energy, is unique. His personal relationships with politicians, control over public discourse via X and strategic placement in critical industries give him outsized power to shape policy in ways previous corporate figures haven't. What can be done? There should be congressional oversight and investigations. Lawmakers should examine whether contract decisions involving Musk's companies are being made fairly. We need stronger anti-monopoly and procurement laws. Government agencies should ensure competitive bidding processes are followed. Also increase whistleblower protections. Employees and insiders aware of unfair or corrupt contract awards should be able to report them without retaliation. There should be more public pressure and media exposure. Investigative journalism can expose potential abuses of power and push for accountability. In conclusion, if Musk is leveraging government influence to favor his businesses at taxpayer expense, it fits the definition of corporate corruption and self-dealing. While billionaires have always had influence, Musk's direct control over critical industries, media platforms, and political narratives makes his case especially concerning. This level of unchecked power demands greater scrutiny and transparency.
Committing fraud against the United States is a felony and must be proven in a court of law supported by concrete evidence. I've been a whistleblower on a few federal cases involving Medicare fraud on a corporate level, so I do have some firsthand knowledge of fraud accusations and how the system works. With both cases, the DOJ investigators and I had to diligently unearth concrete evidence for the DOJ to assess before even deciding to go to trial. The investigation process often takes 3 or more years, as the evidence produced must meet very high standards and not be based merely on data input inaccuracies and hearsay, but must be able to prove beyond the shadow of a doubt there was actual intent along with the knowledge of committing a fraudulent act for the purpose of receiving government compensation. Elon Musk has made bold claims about discovering government fraud and yet has provided no supporting evidence. Government fraud is a felony. If he found evidence of fraud, shouldn't it be required to be reported to the DOJ?
Elon Musk, as head of the Department of Government Efficiency, has made numerous claims regarding significant fraud within U.S. federal programs, such as Social Security. These allegations include assertions that millions of non-citizens have been issued Social Security numbers and that numerous accounts belong to individuals over 120 years old or deceased. Federal law mandates that individuals who uncover evidence of government fraud report it to the appropriate authorities. The Department of Justice oversees the investigation and prosecution of such fraud through statutes like the False Claims Act. Reporting mechanisms include contacting the FBI or submitting information via the DOJ's online portals. Despite Musk's public statements, there is currently no publicly available evidence confirming that he has formally reported these alleged fraudulent activities to the DOJ or other relevant agencies. Critics have noted a lack of substantiated proof accompanying his claims. Additionally, some of Musk's assertions have been challenged. For instance, reports of Social Security numbers associated with individuals aged 150 years have been attributed to outdated data systems rather than active fraud. In summary, while Musk has highlighted potential issues within government programs, the absence of formal reporting and corroborative evidence raises questions about the validity of these claims and the appropriate channels for addressing such concerns.
Musk claims to have found 400,000 Social Security numbers taken by a scammer. He is not specifying if the numbers are being used to collect Social Security payments or if they are being used by illegal aliens to obtain employment in the United States. There are estimates of over 3 million fake Social Security numbers being used by illegal aliens to work in businesses such as meatpacking plants and the construction industry. It seems these illegal immigrants may be contributing to both Medicare and Social Security rather than sucking resources from these programs, as the current administration claims. If someone were to use a fake Social Security number while being employed, isn't he or she contributing to Medicare and Social Security without the possibility of ever using the benefits, thus adding additional money to the general funds?
Yes, Jim, that's correct. When someone uses a fake or stolen Social Security number for employment, their payroll taxes, including contributions to Social Security and Medicare, are deducted from their wages just like any other worker. However, because the Social Security number used does not match their identity, they are unlikely to ever claim the benefits associated with those contributions. A 2013 report by the Social Security Administration estimated that approximately 3.9 million individuals were working with Social Security numbers that did not match their names, which would indicate the use of false or stolen Social Security numbers. Additionally, a 2010 study by the Congressional Research Service suggested that about 75% of unauthorized immigrants were paying payroll taxes, implying they were using Social Security numbers, either legitimate ones not assigned to them or fabricated numbers, to secure employment. The Social Security Administration places earnings from mismatched or fraudulent Social Security numbers into what's called the Earning Suspense File, ESF. As of recent estimates, the ESF has accumulated over $1.2 trillion in uncredited wages. This money ultimately helps bolster the Social Security and Medicare trust funds, essentially acting as extra contributions that won't be paid out in benefits. In this way, undocumented workers who use false Social Security numbers inadvertently provide financial support to these programs without ever being able to claim the retirement, disability, or survivor benefits their payroll taxes help fund.
Wow, $1.2 trillion has actually been added to Social Security in the Medicare system rather than taken from the system by illegal aliens? Imagine that. It really goes against the extreme right-wing narrative. It just seems this fact never seems to be brought up in the public discourse when negative statements about illegal aliens abusing public resources without paying for them are constantly coming from the fear-mongering right-wing media machine and echoed by right-wing politicians. Getting back to Musk, Elon Musk has a history of being an anti-labor employer and not providing safe working conditions for his employees. Can you elaborate?
Elon Musk's leadership at companies like Tesla and SpaceX has been marked by significant tensions with labor organizations and concerns over workplace safety. With labor relations and unionization efforts, there's an anti-union stance. Musk has publicly expressed opposition to labor unions. In 2023, he stated, "I disagree with the idea of unions, describing them as creating a lords and peasants scenario. There are many legal challenges. Tesla has faced multiple unfair labor practice charges. Since 2017, the National Labor Relations Board has investigated allegations that Tesla coerces and intimidates workers through confidentiality agreements that hinder discussions about unionization. Unionization efforts have been vehemently suppressed. In February 2023, Tesla terminated employees at its New York plant following their initiation of unionization efforts, actions perceived by many as retaliatory. There are workplace safety concerns with Musk's companies. There are very high injury rates. Investigations have revealed alarming safety issues." A 2023 Reuters report documented over 600 workplace injuries at SpaceX, including severe incidents like crushed limbs, amputations, electrocutions, and one fatality. There are also many regulatory violations. Tesla's Fremont factory recorded three times as many Occupational Safety and Health Administration violations as the 10 largest U.S. auto plants combined, highlighting significant safety lapses. Then there are fatal incidents. In August 2024, an electrician died from electrocution at Tesla's Gigafactory near Austin, leading to federal citations for workplace safety violations. There are many outstanding governmental oversight and actions, such as regulatory challenges. But magically in 2025, the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs, which investigated companies for unfair practices, including Tesla, was dissolved by executive order, raising concerns about diminished oversight of labor practices. There are many data access controversies. Musk's Department of Government Efficiency gained access to the federal personnel and payroll system despite internal warnings, allowing viewing of sensitive information for 276,000 federal employees. In conclusion, Elon Musk's companies have faced significant criticism and legal scrutiny regarding labor relations and workplace safety. Allegations of anti-union practices, high injury rates, and regulatory violations suggest a complex dynamic between Musk's pursuit of innovation and the maintenance of fair labor standards and safe working environments.
Elon Musk seems to lack empathy for his fellow human beings and seems to feel he is the supreme being on the human hierarchical scale. From my own background in psychology and professional counseling, as I have a bachelor's degree in psychology and a master's degree in professional counseling, this seems to go way beyond Asperger's symptoms and ventures into possibly having a narcissistic personality disorder, almost to the point of being a sociopath. Would you agree with this possible assessment?
Assessing the psychological profile of a public figure like Elon Musk requires caution, as definitive diagnoses should be made by qualified professionals through direct evaluation. However, observations of Musk's behavior have led some to speculate about certain personality traits. His narcissistic personality traits include grandiosity and self-promotion. Musk's ambitious ventures and public statements often reflect a high degree of self-confidence and a belief in his exceptional capabilities. This aligns with characteristics commonly associated with narcissistic personality disorder, such as an exaggerated sense of self-importance and a need for admiration. There is also a lack of empathy. Reports suggest that Musk's interactions with employees and associates can be perceived as lacking empathy. His biographer, Walter Isaacson, has compared Musk to Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, indicating a duality in his personality that includes moments of harshness and insensitivity. His sociopathic tendencies include his impulsivity and risk-taking behavior. Musk's willingness to engage in high-stakes ventures and make bold decisions without apparent concern for potential negative outcomes may suggest traits associated with sociopathy, such as impulsivity and a disregard for consequences. He also displays very manipulative behavior. Some analyses propose that Musk's strategic maneuvers in business and public relations exhibit manipulative tendencies, a characteristic often linked to sociopathic behavior. Here are a few public criticisms and observations. With employee relations, critics have labeled Musk as a monster bully, citing his demanding management style and the pressure placed on employees to meet his high expectations. With his personal relationships, allegations from individuals like influencer Ashley St. Clair, who accused Musk of withdrawing financial support to maintain control and punish, further fuel discussions about his interpersonal conduct. In conclusion, while certain behaviors exhibited by Elon Musk align with traits associated with narcissistic personality disorder and sociopathy, it is essential to recognize that only a qualified mental health professional can make an accurate diagnosis. Public observations and reports provide limited insight and should be interpreted with caution.
And finally, is Elon Musk trying to reshape the U.S. government into his own vision of governance?
Elon Musk's involvement in U.S. government operations has intensified since his appointment as head of the Department of Government Efficiency, established by President Donald Trump on January 20, 2025. Its mission is to modernize federal technology and reduce government spending. There has been a major influence on government operations, such as budgetary reductions. Under Musk's leadership, DOGE has implemented significant budget cuts across various federal agencies. For example, the Internal Revenue Service experienced staff reductions, leading to concerns about decreased audits for wealthy individuals and potential increases in tax evasion. There have been program revisions. DOGE has targeted programs related to climate change, scientific research, and diversity, equity, and DEI initiatives, resulting in their reduction or elimination. These actions have sparked legal challenges and public protests. The public response and criticism of Musk's governmental influence. There have been protests. The Tesla takedown movement exemplifies public dissent against Musk's influence, with protests occurring at Tesla dealerships worldwide. Participants expressed concern over the perceived erosion of democratic processes and the centralization of power. There is also legal scrutiny. DOGE's activities have faced legal challenges, including accusations of conflict of interest and overreach in accessing sensitive government data. Critics argue that Musk's dual role as a government advisor and leader of private enterprises presents ethical dilemmas. In conclusion, Elon Musk's leadership of DOGE signifies concerted effort to reshape aspects of the U.S. government in line with his vision for efficiency and technological advancement. While his initiatives aim to streamline operations and reduce waste, they have also ignited debates about transparency, accountability, and the appropriate extent of private influence in public governance.
I would like to thank you, Noah, for all of the in-depth answers that you provided today. If any listeners have any questions they would like to submit for me to ask, please submit them to angryboomerjim@gmail.com. It's all one word, angryboomerjim@gmail.com. Thank you for listening today. I was going to end with a song, Sieg Heil Elon, but the song just wasn't quite ready, so I guess I dozed it, and I'm going to replace it with a poem I wrote. The name of this poem is Born into Privilege.
South Africa, of new pure white blood, born into privilege on the white side of the wall. On the other, well, only desperation and despair. elite private schools to attend, at home waiting were servants of color. His childhood bubble, his own pleasure island, a world of segregation, a world of whites only. When called to duty, his devotion was strictly self-serving. Empathy, compassion, and concern for others were not of his nature. They never were. When it demanded too much of him, his bubble was quickly abandoned, high and dry. To the top of this huge spinning rock, from one northern country to another. Attended a few institutions of higher knowledge, degree from one, but abandoned the others. Father's seeds onto the business world, from one tech venture to another, bought and lucratively sold, millions to billions piled ever so high, a new empire built upon the blood, sweat, and sacrifice of many others. Human beings no more than disposable pawns, along the way discarded when service is no longer required. Efficiency is merely dollars and cents, with human lives reduced to nothing more than mere digits on a ledger. A ketamine-fueled maniac with rockets to crash and burn, human suffering is of no absolute concern. In his mind, he's on top, all others so far below. Visionary visions strictly of his own, without concern for the needs or wants of others. But when it comes to true visionaries, I'll take the likes of H.G. Wells any day, for his visions gave inspiration and hope of a better world to come, not delivered on the road paved with humanity laid to waste.
Thank you. And I plan on having another episode for the Easter holiday weekend. Thank you.